rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Yes, it's just a rebranded Red Box. If you previously enjoyed Red Box, it's exactly the same. It's just called Politics Without the Boring Bits now, because that's what my Times Radio show is all about. Coming up on today's episode, did Nicola Sturgeon kill independence? After an extraordinary 12 months of the SNP, Humza Yousaf, the SNP First Minister, is out and about. Anna Sawar, the Scottish Labour leader, is out and about, both making pitches for each other's supporters. And obviously Scotland is absolutely crucial to what happens in the general election. That's coming up in our big thing. We'll also have a sneak peek of this week's episode of How to Win an Election. And don't forget, if you want to listen to Politics Without the Boring Bits live, join me on Times Radio for free on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. Good news for lawbreakers. Good morning, Mr. Johnson. Mark Drakeford has offered up a new defence. The Welsh First Minister was being asked yesterday about enforcement of his 20-mile-per-hour limit.
I think if the police find somebody driving above 20 miles an hour, and the reason is because, you know, they are genuinely confused about that, then that's why the police will always start with education and conversation. And I don't think in those circumstances of genuine confusion, the police will move to enforcement.
Great news, great news. So if you are caught by the police speeding, not wearing a seatbelt, breaking lockdown rules, or accidentally prosecuting sub-postmasters for mistakes made in your IT system, you now have a ready-made excuse. You were just a victim of
genuine confusion.
Easy peasy, easy peasy. And now a short advertisement break.
Milk! Ugh!
I'm here in Accrington in the northwest to see Levelling Up in action.
Accrington Stanley! Who are they?
Exactly!
Nah, get off! Give me some! Get off!
One for the kids there. Yeah, the Prime Minister has had his milk, which makes a change from his usual tipple.
Yeah, I'm a coke addict. Total coke addict.
Right, now, as we always do on a Tuesday, we bring you a little taster of this week's episode of How to Win an Election. Stronger podcasts, fairer podcasts, podcasts for everyone. Strike up the band!
Let Sunak be Sunak is different from Let Sunak be Cummings.
Try it's and all start the year being a little fair to Edmund Levan, will you, Danny?
They absolutely should not water this down to the point of homeopathic disappearance.
Here we are again then. It's How to Win an Election with me, Matt Chorley, joined as ever by our political masterminds, New Labour mastermind Peter Mandelson, Polly McKenzie's Policy McKenzie, formerly Nick Clegg's brain, Director of Policy for the Lib Dems, and Tory brain box Daniel Finkston. How are we all?
Fine. We just had a bit of a debate about whether Matt's jacket is dapper or not, which is even more amusing for people listening because they can have to imagine.
You better watch it. You can watch it back on YouTube.
Dapper. Peter was a bit more sceptical about it than Polly was.
It's quite soft. I think there's a lack of interfacing.
Is there? You mean it's not got strong shoulders?
No. Maybe it's the problem, I've not got strong shoulders. Maybe. Do you think of anyone else who's not got strong shoulders, Peter?
Come on, you've got better shoulders than Ed Miliband.
Peter's wearing a sort of black polo neck. Sort of.
I know.
Milk train, man.
Rather raffish.
Raffish, I think raffish is a good word. Well, let us know what you think about what we're all wearing. You can email howtowin@thetimes.co.uk if you are watching on YouTube. Now, we've had some emails. Last week, Polly, we were talking about your elections to watch. You chose Taiwan. Well, we've had an email about what you said. Says, hi, I'm Xu Yang. I speak Chinese. And I just want to say that Polly's pronunciation of
KMT Kuomintang
on the previous episode was absolutely accurate.
Phew.
Glad that one of the three chose the Taiwanese elections because it matters. And under the current circumstances, it's romantic to Happy New Year. So there we are. Well done. If you want to get in touch, how to win election at thetimes.co.uk. Now, we're going to talk about smaller parties, but particularly the Lib Dems, because Ed Davies all splashed all over the papers, which is normally what the Lib Dems would like, but possibly not for the reason that he would. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But since we last met, Rishi Sunak has said his working assumption is the election will be in the second half of the year. Ben emailed in from Portishead, the place, not the group, he says. Sunak has just talked about the general election being in the second half of the year. People are taking this at face value and saying it'll then be in the autumn. I think he could be doing this to wrongfoot Labour so they'll be caught off guard when he calls a snap election in the spring. What do you think, Peter?
I think that's a pretty astute observation because he hasn't ruled out an autumn election. Working assumption is the sort of vaguest formulation he could get away with. Obviously, the speculation about the election was sort of getting under his skin, as so much else is seemingly doing these days with the Prime Minister. But I think, you know, if he saw, for example, you know, the sort of green shoots of economic recovery and by some sort of miraculous sort of renaissance, the economy suddenly started looking up, he might make a dash for it. Or if he saw in the Labour Party some policy weakness or division or whatever, he might want to take advantage of that. I mean, I can't think in the Labour Party what policy area might come before their absolute determination to win the election, but it's possible. Of course, if he does delay it to the autumn, then he's giving the Labour Party plenty of time to iron out any policy weaknesses and friction. So in a sense, he might be doing the Labour Party a favour.
It's basically what you suggested last week, isn't it, Danny? He had to sort of hose it down without categorically ruling it out.
Yeah, I think he has pretty much. I mean, I think if we've learnt something about Rishi Sunak in the last year, it is that his political calculation is not his greatest game. So I just think maybe you might, as Prime Minister, have tried to lure the Labour Party onto the rocks. I just think he told us when he's thinking of holding the general election. And if you aren't going to hold the general election in May and you aren't going to hold it in January 2025, it's better probably to say it. So my view is we now know, roughly speaking, when the election is. There's a small chance, of course, in all things that it won't be then. But by and large, we know when it is. And so we can stop discussing that and concentrate on what actually are the issues. Yeah, yeah. By the way, if the reason why I don't think this is the right thing to do, to wait till October, November, is because if you try to put a list together of the things that might change between now and then, you're hard put to it to discover what they are. And so therefore, I think a feeling that an election has been delayed will simply build a case, but will build a momentum against the Conservatives. So I wouldn't have done this, but if I was going to do it, if I was going to hold it in the autumn, he clearly wants to do that. I sort of thought he probably would, and if he does want to do that, then it's right to say so that at least he doesn't get the, everyone thinks he's going to go in May, and then he says at the last minute he's not going to.
And actually, I was struck at the weekend, Keir Starmer saying that all he's doing is he wants to clock up 2 years in Downing Street. It's putting vanity before country. That sort of mood could start. But the one thing it has done is ruled out your theory, Polly, that we're going to end up having an election in 2025.
Well, he said it's not going to happen. Yeah. There are no guarantees in politics. He's definitely in a stronger position now, because if he had allowed that speculation to continue, then going for the autumn would look weak. Now, on the off chance he does go for May, it looks strong to do so. Like Danny, I think that his best bet for the Conservative Party would be to go early, to go in the spring. I still don't think he will. Mm. And what if bad things come along in October and November and there's bad news? he still could string it out just to get that extra year onto his.
Well, I suppose that's a calculation. You could be waiting for something to turn up, but the risk is that something might turn up.
Well, I'll tell you what I think the risk of turning up is Donald Trump in the autumn, if as is almost certain to be the case, he's the Republican candidate. He is going to run a mother and father of campaigns, and that's going to coincide with and overlap with Rishi Sunak's election campaign. And I think that's a sort of association he doesn't want to invite. They will be running, after all, similar campaigns. I mean, small estate, lower taxes, tough on immigration, etc. And I think that what...
Danny, you're wincing.
That's even more stretched than your jumper neck.
But why do you say that?
That they're going to be running similar campaigns. Indeed, I think, actually, I'd put it to you that the difficulty for Sunak will be exactly the opposite. It's quite considerable, this difficulty. I agree with that. But the difficulty is simply that there'll be a populist campaign to Sunak's right by the Faragists, maybe even by Nigel Farage. Mm-hmm. It will gain a lot of energy from Donald Trump's campaign. There'll be pressure on Sunak to run Donald Trump's election campaign, but he neither has the inclination to do that, nor the capacity for it, because he's a very different
person.
But
what's the alternative, Danny? I mean, he has already decided to open the new year by being not the change candidate, but the continuity candidate. Britain's on the right track. Don't risk it with Labour.
Well, in fact, let's just remind ourselves of that, because Danny's previously talked about the three types of elections: time for a change, on the right track, or better the devil you know. So here he was being changey-changey at the party conference in October.
But the worst thing about Sir Keir is that he just says whatever he thinks will benefit him the most. Doesn't matter whether he can deliver it. Doesn't matter if it's true. It doesn't matter if he said the opposite just a few weeks or months ago. He is the walking definition of the 30-year political status quo I am here to end.
So there he was, changey-changey. And then this is him yesterday.
Now, the choice facing our country at that election is, do we stick with the plan that is starting to deliver the long-term change that our country needs, or do we go back to square one?
So this is a major switch in strategy. I hadn't realised it had been quite as stark as it is. But he is becoming the continuity candidate. And he is spearheading this campaign, Danny, I'm afraid, on two issues. One is lower taxation, which he can only advocate by embracing a smaller state. The state doing less and spending less in order to give lower taxes instead. And the other is immigration, which is still a drum that he keeps on beating, I think, in a rather futile way. But nonetheless, there's colossal pressure in his, both within his party and outside his party, in the reform, to pursue these issues. Now, you say, well, that's got nothing to do with Donald Trump. It just so happens that those are Donald Trump's issues.
The second of those is, but the first of them, lower, smaller state, is not really, and lower taxation isn't really Donald Trump's theme. He is running a populist campaign, which is about the whole nature of the establishment. It is indeed the campaign that Rishi Sunak, I did think, did dally with, but could never have pulled off because he's not Donald Trump. So I think that the idea that those two will be the same
he's
is
basically
just not
true. Donald Trump is doing both these things. Of course he wants to offer lower taxes and a smaller state while saving everyone from oblivion. I mean, he's a sort of Johnsonian character. He's both, a nationalist and somebody who wants to bail everyone out of their troubles by spewing out populist slogans the entire time. But the point I'm making is that, in the media, in the public's mind, there will be these two campaigns running in parallel, and there will be a lot of pressure on Sunak, both within his party and from the Faragists in the Reform Party, to change course and strike a more populist right-wing set of notes. Trump will be doing the same in the United States. All these things are at risk of merging in the public's mind. And for a candidate like Sunak, who has to broaden his base and reach out to the centre of politics, if he's going to stand any chance, I think it's not brave. brand enhancing for him.
Polly, what do you make of all this?
I think Peter's also done an about turn.
Oh.
Because you said that he was going to run a campaign like Trump, and now you're saying that he's going to come under pressure to run a campaign like Trump. So I've slightly lost...
Well, the two things are not opposite.
I mean, he will come under pressure because a lot of people in his own party don't want continuity conservatism because they don't think it's real conservatism.
No, I think that,
they want a real conservative campaign headed by a real conservative leader, you know, with real conservative policies. And we all know where that
ends. I think it's the reason why Sunak has pivoted so much from one set of campaign messages to something completely different is because he isn't holding his party together. He is coming under pressure. He doesn't really know who he is or what he is that he wants to do.
And at what point does that... Because clearly what he's done is he's tried one thing and he thought, well, that's not worked. You know, he tried just quiet delivery, his five pledges a year ago, gave that 6 months, that didn't work. There was a wobble over the summer. He became the change candidate in the autumn. That didn't work. Then he brought back David Cameron, so he can't be the change candidate if he's attacking David Cameron. David Cameron didn't. But at what point does all that sort of flip-flopping, I mean, what they accuse Keir Starmer of, does that become a problem in and of itself? It's not just that he keeps changing, it's that people can seize all over the place.
Well, it's interesting as well that the sort of the half-life of these individual slogans is reducing, right? Like 6 months, 3 months, we've got exponential reductions in the length of his campaign slogans. So there will come a point when people will notice that he has not said the same thing more than 2 days in a row. And the way that desperation harms strategy is becoming more and more apparent. They are casting around because they're frightened.
Yeah, look, I think it was lamentable to put forward that, in my view, absurd time for a change strategy. I understood why they did it, because there's a public mood that it's time for a change and because continuity will be so difficult to make work, but it was obviously not going to be able to land it. I think therefore the criticism that's being levelled against them is completely merited. However, it's also important to remember that literally nobody knows that he made that speech, except for a few political aficionados, that he made a speech about change. It'll have damaged his reputation among people who are commenting like us about his political strategy, but really the crucial thing is, does he land with enough time on broadly the correct strategy? And I think he has. So I'm pleased about that. I think, as we've discussed before, the biggest problem he's got, and Polly's put it so well, that's a brilliant phrase about the impact of desperation on political strategy. The problem for the Conservative Party is none of these strategies, time for a change, better the devil you know, or continuity, Britain's on the right track, none of them quite work. But of the three of them, this is definitely the best one.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I think it's harder than you imagine to run a continuity. You know, Britain's doing well, Britain's heading in the right direction, isn't Britain looking up, so let's just continue. That fights completely with reality, the national mood, and what voters think.
You see,
I think there's a variation of change which he could have adopted. And it is the 1986 Thatcher model of the next steps forward. He's got to say, what is the point of voting for a fifth
term? But that was Britain's on the right track. I mean, they actually used that slogan.
Yeah, I know, Danny. but they also had a programme which they launched in their 1986 conference, a year ahead of the election, where she set out all the next things that a Conservative government was going to do. We haven't seen hide nor hair.
No, I agree with that. So I'm not saying, you've got to show, when you say Britain's on the right track, you've got to show what the track is, obviously. Fred, you do. I mean,
well, I think people know what the track is. What they want to know is, where is this track leading to?
That's what I mean by track.
What is a re-elected fifth-term what are the building blocks? What do they do next?
That's why they say stop in your tracks when you're not going anywhere. But I'm talking about going down a track.
Yeah.
And we're getting lost in our metaphors here. The point about Britain's on the right track, don't turn back, is that it's a strategy that says we've got a direction. If you want to keep on doing these things, we know where we're going, we know what the next steps are. And that's the only strategy.
Is what is absent.
No, but I'm saying there's no sign of that. They've now endorsed the fact that they're going to try to advance that, and that's a good thing.
But it's really hard for them to do it when the Conservative Party has had five prime ministers, yeah. five different sets of tracks of that they have been on.
Of course.
Most of whom going in conflicting areas, directions. Each different prime minister has slagged off the previous prime minister. And so I think that's why we had Danny Kruger, a backbench MP, talking this week. Leaked comments saying that, unfortunately, the country is in a worse off situation than it was 13 years ago when the Conservatives took power. And as Peter says, if that is people's kind of lived experience, their reality on the ground, then saying it's starting to work, like, that's fine for Margaret Thatcher in her going into her second term, right? It's starting to work, which is what's...
It wasn't her second term.
It was going into a third. The third election in 86.
86. I thought you said 80. Anyway, whatever. I'm too young. Too young. It's hard truth.
Are you starting to become a bit ageist? Is this what's creeping in here?
Look, yes,
also,
absolutely.
We shouldn't forget what the real Conservative campaign is going to be about, and that is Labour, 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 Labour. And he will be day in, day out trying to work out how he can get into the single sentence. Right up until polling day, the words Labour, higher taxes, additional borrowing.
Yes. Yeah.
That is what the Conservative campaign is heading towards.
So it'll be an interesting question, Matt, is will he abandon the second part of the strategy, which is the bit where he says the problem with Starmer is he's all over the shop and you don't know what he stands for, in favour of he's very dangerous. So that's the other bit.
Because he can't both be very dangerous and not believe in anything.
Correct. That's a choice as well.
Up next, we're not going to do Labour, 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 Labour. We're going to do Lib Dem, Lib Dem, Lib Dem, Lib Dem. Ed Davey is all over the papers. He's facing calls to resign. It's always, you know, the big problem the small party often has is trying to get attention, but is this the sort of attention they need? And what role will they play in the next election? We'll do that next on How to Win an Election. And if you want to listen to the full episode of How to Win an Election, just search for How to Win an Election wherever you're listening to this. Up next, did Nicola Sturgeon kill independence?
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
The Big Thing.
Yeah, we're coming up to a year since Nicola Sturgeon quit as leader of the SNP and, of course, First Minister. She said at the time it was the best path forward for Scottish independence.
But I am firmly of the view that there is now majority support for independence in Scotland. But that support needs to be solidified and it needs to grow further if our independent Scotland is to have the best possible foundation. To achieve that, we must reach across the divide in Scottish politics. And my judgment now is that a new leader will be better able to do this.
But coming up to 1 year on, has that plan been scotched? Humza Yousaf, her successor, thinks not. He kicked off the SNP's general election campaign with a speech in Glasgow, pitching to voters that independence would be a boost to Scotland's economy.
The UK is the poor man of Northwest Europe. Those trends were already taking hold before Brexit. Leaving the European Union means a further long-term hit to the economy. All the while, Tories and Labour offer nothing new. But for Scotland, there is a choice. We can accept our place as part of this low productivity, high inequality economic model, or we can decide to chart a better course.
In terms of Yousaf there, is he appealed to people across the spectrum to back the SNP. Then, just down the road in Rutherglen, Scottish Labour leader Anna Sawa made a speech aimed at pro-independence voters. He called on them to defect from the SNP to, quote, boot the Tories out, saying, "We may ultimately disagree on the final destination for Scotland, but on this part of the journey, let's unite to change our country." Meanwhile, this morning, the Scottish Conservatives leader, Douglas Ross, told the BBC that his general election strategy will be to convince voters to focus on the economy, not independence.
His independent speech promised economic miracles that he can't deliver. You know, he can't get ferries to sail a vital lifeline for our communities, but he thinks he can walk on water. His independence paper is a threat to the Scottish economy, and we know that it's only the Scottish Conservatives that can stop the SNP in many of these seats right across Scotland, and that's what we'll be doing. We're up for this fight against the SNP at the general election, and it's absolutely vital that we stop their divisive plans for another independence referendum and get the focus onto the real priorities of people across Scotland.
So that's the Conservative leader in Scotland, Douglas Ross. But with Labour now currently ahead of the SNP in the polls, is Scottish independence dead? Or at least for the time being. We thought it was time to convene our armchair generals.
CCHQ, Chorley Campaign Headquarters.
Yes, a Scottish edition of CCHQ with our experts in what is going on in Scottish politics. Kieran Andrews, the Times' Scottish political editor. Hi, Kieran.
Good morning, Matt.
And Katrina Stewart is at the Herald. Hi, Katrina.
Good morning.
So let's start with Humza Yousaf then, Kieran. Clearly, 2023 was a bad year for the SNP. They lost Nicola Sturgeon. Shortly after that, she was questioned by police over there as part of their investigation into the SNP's party finances. She'd been released without charge and denies any wrongdoing. Others, her husband was arrested as well, former chief executive of the SNP. Is there any hope for the SNP that this year might be better than last?
Well, 2023 was certainly the year that Humza Yousaf had to deal, for the vast majority of it, with problems that were not of his own making. As you point out, there was a lot of hangover from Nicola Sturgeon's time in office that just overshadowed pretty much everything that Humza Yousaf did as First Minister. What we're starting to see now is Humza Yousaf creating some of those problems for himself, or at least certainly charting a course that he will have to... You know, he'll have no one else to blame for. We've seen the Scottish budget, which was published just before Christmas, which will put in place a new tax band and increase the tax differential between people working in Scotland and people working in England and Wales. So if there's any blowback from that on Humza Yousaf, that is not something he can pin back on Nicola Sturgeon. You know, we're now into a phase of Scottish politics where Humza Yousaf is having to take responsibility for his own actions with the SNP and Labour pretty much neck and neck in the polls, and a lot of SNP MPs pretty worried about their seats in the upcoming general election.
Katrina, that sounds a bit like he took a bad, he was dealt a bad set of cards and he's made it worse.
Yeah, I mean, he hasn't had his troubles to seek, certainly. And I think the majority of Scottish voters just want to know what life is going to look like in the immediate term post the general election. They want to know in practical terms what is going to be happening to make their lives better, because everybody is fatigued and disillusioned with politics. You have Labour making big noises about how they're going to transform politics, make it a sort of lighter experience on people's lives. People aren't going to have to engage with identity politics and aren't going to have to sort of have these very stressful interactions with political squabbling. But Hamza Yousaf has also talked about how he's going to bring positivity into politics. But I think people just want policies. They want to know what's happening. And it's a very kind of easy attack line to look at the speech yesterday and say, well, you know, this is all fine and well, but it's pie in the sky for the moment because there isn't a route towards independence. Yes, there is support for independence that has remained relatively static. But ultimately, it doesn't matter to the majority of voters unless you're very passionate about Scottish independence. You want to know what's going to be happening with your lives in the immediate term.
In fact, so one of the key claims he made was that every Scottish household would be £10,000 better off.
The Resolution Foundation said that if the United Kingdom had the average income and inequality of similar countries, then the typical household would be £8,300 better off. And if we use that very same analysis for countries that are similar to Scotland, the prize for the typical Scottish household would be even greater. They would be £10,200 better off. That, then, is the huge prize of independence.
I mean, I suppose the main question is, Kieran, does that stack up? I mean, Katrina makes the point, it's a bit pie in the sky because there's no prospect of that coming, but do those numbers even add up?
Well, we asked the Resolution Foundation yesterday about the Scottish Government's adding up of their figures, extrapolation of their figures, and they refused to comment but made it clear that they have done no modelling on Scottish independence, which suggests they were less than happy about the Scottish Government taking their figures for a different set of analysis and just applying it to an independent Scotland and leaving it hanging there as the potential prize. But we have seen this. It's the battle over independence was always about the battle for how many pounds would be in people's pockets, but of course that again depends on the currency prospectus for an independent Scotland. But you saw in the run-up to the 2014 referendum, the Better Together campaign pushed hard, saying that people would be a couple of thousand pounds better off in the union. The Yes campaign said the same, almost exactly the same figures, I think, about people being better off under independence. And in the last few years, that number, the kind of figure that's been put on it by SNP leaders as to how much better you'd be off under independence has grown from about £2,000 to now £10,500, which is even under recent inflation figures is quite something.
And so I suppose, again, it just goes back to that question of, if you're going to make those claims and there's no prospect of independence coming, then it all feels a bit far off. Let's turn our attention then to Labour's Anna Sawa, because he made his speech in Rutherglen yesterday, where Rutherglen obviously being where they won the by-election. He was making a direct appeal, Katrina, to independence voters to sort of lend their votes to him in order to, quote, boot the Tories out. Is that a sort of a new, being so blatant about your pitch to voters, is that a new move by Labour?
He's certainly very explicit about it. I mean, I think in this race, everyone is trying to ride two horses at once. You've got both leaders who are really trying to reach out across the divide on independence. So Hamza Yousaf was saying yesterday that, yes, absolutely, not everyone's going to agree with the cause of independence, but their views should be respected. Whereas Anna Sawa is essentially saying that, you know, the immediate term solution, that is the limited prospect of the second referendum and the current Conservative government, are enough to warrant independent supporters voting Labour for now. But of course, if Scottish Labour is appealing to independent voters to help them on the path to success, then he needs to be ready to answer the obvious question, which is, what do independent voters get in return? And I think that's going to be a kind of crucial point for him to answer if he's going to labour on scooping up undecided independent supporters.
It's an interesting approach that, Kieran, because, you know, Douglas Ross seemed to be trying to move away from talking about independence at all and talk about other things. Is there a risk here for Labour that by using the I word a lot, you are just you're letting the SNP set the agenda?
Well, I don't think Anas Sawar is using the I word all that much. What he is doing is trying to hoover up, as Katrina said, disaffected SNP voters. You know, the gap that there is in the polls between people who still support independence but who don't support the SNP anymore. And, you know, effectively, there's a cohort in Scotland of voters who are somewhere in the middle, who probably do support independence, don't think it's a priority at the moment. And those are the people that Anas Sawar is trying to hoover up by saying, you know, the general election is about getting a new government across the UK, getting rid of the Conservatives, and so lend your vote to Labour. And what he'll be hoping for there, notwithstanding the potential issues down the line, you look forward to horrid elections that Katrina rightly identified, what he'll be hoping for is that once people have lent their vote to Labour once, it becomes a lot easier to do it in the future. We saw that the SNP did brilliantly to build on that from 2007 through 2011 in successive Holroyd elections, where they got Labour voters to come over, just give us a chance, see what it's like. And once you've broken that habit of voting for a specific party, it becomes a lot easier to do in the future.
Well, let's try and get under the bonnet of the numbers on this then. Let's bring in John Curtis, Professor John Curtis, a polling guru from the University of Strathclyde. John, when Nicola Sturgeon resigned last year, a poll came out saying that more than half, in fact, 59% said that over half of Scots thought Nicola Sturgeon's resignation had damaged the case for independence. 54% it was at the time, John. Do you think that's panned out over the last 12 months?
No, Nicola Sturgeon's resignation has not had any obvious impact on the level of support for independence, as Katrina has already mentioned, but it did do an awful lot of damage to the SNP. I mean, it was interesting, as you presented that clip at the beginning of this discussion, the truth is that the thing that went most badly wrong for the SNP last year was Nicola Sturgeon's decision to resign. At the moment that she resigned, the SNP were still running at 43% on average in polls for Westminster voting intentions, only marginally down on the 45% they got in 2019. By the time that Humza Yousaf had been elected leader and before any of the arrests associated with the allegations about the SNP's finances, about which, of course, we've heard nothing more for a very long time, support for the SNP was down at 38%. So most of the decline in SNP support occurred in the immediate wake of Nicola Sturgeon's decision to resign and Humza Yousaf being elected as her successor. It does mean, of course, that the problem that the SNP faces now can't simply be blamed on the misfortune of the SNP's finances, although it did do some further damage further down the track, or indeed that the fact that people are not interested in independence and don't support it. That's not true. The problem the SNP face is with themselves as a political organisation. And to that extent, at least, therefore, the question facing the SNP is not how do they advance the cause for independence in the minds of voters, although that is a long-term task that faces them. But that's what Mr. Yousaf was talking about yesterday. Rather, it's about persuading people that the SNP are indeed standard bearers for the cause of independence, in whom they should be continuing to invest their trust. And it's the willingness of some yes voters, at least, to maintain that trust that is now in some doubt.
It was striking. I was looking back, and there aren't that many polls in Scotland, the same as we see right across the UK. But, I mean, in November, 15% of people who voted yes in 2014 said they were going to vote Labour. I think that was up about 3 points on the year before. So it didn't feel like there were, at least up to that point in November, and clearly we're a couple of months on from that now. Is there any sign that that is actually working? Or is it that the Labour Party are taking the votes from, I don't know, the Lib Dems, the Tories, other parts of the electorate, rather than reaching directly to the SNP?
There are two parts to the story of the Labour revival in Scotland. Part one is nothing to do in particular with politics in Scotland and everything to do with the two dramatic events, i.e. Boris Johnson and Partygate and Liz Truss and her fiscal event that transformed Labour's chances across the UK as a whole. So before the Partygate, Labour was still running up third in the opinion polls in Scotland. In the wake of the Liz Truss fiscal event, they were almost at 30%, up from the 19% of 2019. And that was primarily achieved by winning over voters, yes, and the Conservatives, and becoming displacing the Conservatives as the principal political party being backed by pro-union voters. There is then a second element, which essentially, you know, is in the wake of the Nicola Sturgeon's resignation and then continuing through the summer, whereby the Labour Party have picked up a minority, but a crucial minority, probably around 1 in 6 of those people who currently support independence are currently saying they are voting Labour. I think, you know, the explanations are primarily to do with, one, the fact that Mr. Youssef is not anything like as popular as his predecessor. He's not regarded as doing anything like as good a job as his predecessor. And perhaps also crucially, whereas hitherto it has looked as though the SNP Scottish government was largely immune from losing electoral support because people were unhappy with its record in office. So if I go back, for example, to the spring of 2022, and I look at people's valuations of how well they thought the health service was doing, and their probability that they would vote for the SNP again, what they thought about the health service in Scotland didn't seem to make any difference. Replicate that analysis for 2023, and you discover that indeed those people who voted SNP in 2019, but who are unhappy about the state of the health service, are now less likely to vote for the SNP. To that extent, at least, for some supporters of independence, independence is no longer a sufficiently defining issue that persuades them to vote for the SNP. And indeed, yes, it's the Labour Party who are best able to profit from discontent with the record of the Scottish government and Mr. Youssef being regarded as a less charismatic and a less capable politician than either of his two predecessors as First Minister.
Just finally, John, before we actually speak to the Minister for Independence in the SNP government, based on what you've seen, is Labour on course to replace the SNP as the biggest party in Scotland, going back to the situation we saw a couple of decades ago?
Certainly Labour are not on course to be back to winning 40 seats in Scotland. I think at the moment it's a 50-50 toss-up as to whether or not, if there were an election tomorrow, Labour would get more seats than the SNP. The two parties are quite close to each other. And there are an awful lot of seats in Scotland that are marginal when the two parties are close to each other, and it therefore would depend very much on the outcome of individual seats. The obvious hope for the SNP is that in the end they can persuade some of the people who support independence to swing back to them. That certainly is their potential ballast. For Labour, the hope is that indeed they still look as though they're capable of displacing the Tories, and that in the end their argument that voting Labour is the best way of getting rid of the Conservatives has some influence, although, of course, in practice, it's probably not true, because we know that the SNP would not help to sustain a minority Conservative administration.
Now let's speak to Jamie Hepburn. He's the Minister for Independence in the Scottish Government. John's now. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, good morning.
What's your reading of it? John Curtis says there's a toss-up between whether or not Labour or the SNP will have the most MPs at the next election.
Well, there's no denying, of course, the opinion polls have narrowed, but people write off the SNP at their peril. If you look at the opinion polls over the last year, virtually all of them, the SNP still remains ahead in the polls. And after 16 years in government, I think that's quite some feat. Now, we enter this election on the basis of seeking another mandate from the people of Scotland to continue to advance the independence case. And that's some of what the First Minister was laying out yesterday.
Whose fault is it that you're neck and neck with Labour in that way?
Well, look, we're heading into a UK general election. The context is always a bit of a challenging one for the SNP, and so far as that's one where people might be looking to think who will form the next UK government. But of course, as the people of Scotland look at the supposed alternative in the shape and the form of a Keir Starmer-led Labour Party that's flip-flopping all over the place, it's changed its position on the two-child cap on child benefit. Saying that it'll stick largely to Tory spending plans. Keir Starmer said that the Labour Party are the real Conservatives, and above all, in its position on a Brexit that the people of Scotland didn't vote for, it now supports the position of the UK remaining outside the EU. I think people will start to look at that and say that's no real alternative at all, and recognise the SNP represents the real alternative, and independence for Scotland represents the real alternative future for our country.
Would you rather see Keir Starmer or Rishi Sunak as Prime Minister after the next election?
Well, I think we're all realistic enough to recognise the First Minister made this point yesterday, barring something extraordinary happening between now and the election. Keir Starmer is going to be the next Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. So again, the question for the people of Scotland is, well, what do we want to see as an outcome that election? Do we want to vote for lobby fodder for the Labour Party, or do we want to vote for a group of MPs that will stand up for Scotland and keep the Labour Party honest? It's the SNP that represent that choice, of course, and in contrast to the Labour Party flip-flopping all over the place, you can vote for a party that will stand up for Scotland and make sure that Scotland's voice is heard at Westminster.
The thing is, Keir Starmer can't become Prime Minister unless he wins a lot of seats in Scotland, unless people who previously voted for the SNP vote Labour to, as in the words of Anna Sawai yesterday, boot the Tories out. And actually, if people in Scotland want a voice in the Westminster government, sitting around the cabinet table, they need Scottish Labour MPs, don't they?
I mean, this is one of the great mythologies of British politics, that the Labour Party can't form a UK government without people in Scotland voting for the Labour Party. I think it's only in one instance in the last 60 years that the Labour Party has relied on MPs from Scotland to form a UK government. If they can't win in England, then they're not going to form the next UK government. And all the signs are that that's what they're going to do. So we have an opportunity, we have a chance here in Scotland to make sure that we vote for a group of MPs that will stand up for Scotland, will stick up for Scotland, rather than just go down there and doing what they're told and sitting in the back benches and being lobby fodder for a Labour government that frankly isn't proposing any agenda for change. It's basically looking to offer the continuum and the continuation of the agenda we've seen from the Conservatives over the last decade and more.
What do you make of the prospect of independence? John Curtis there saying that the big impact that happened last year, Nicola Sturgeon's resignation, triggered the shift in support for the SNP. There's no way of you getting independence without the SNP in government in Holyrood, without you having an awful lot of MPs in the House of Commons. The prospect of independence in the near political future is dead, isn't it?
No, I disagree with that. If you look at the opinion polls, there is still substantial support
for
independence, running around 50-50 in the polls. Well, frankly, we get it by persuading the people of Scotland for the case. There's only so long, I believe, that any UK government can stand out and hold out against the popular opinion of people of Scotland. And if people of Scotland continue to vote for those who advocate independence, then they should enable that question to be put to the people of Scotland again.
And if they if they don't continue to vote for the advocates of Scottish independence, if the SNP go backwards in the popular vote and the number of MPs at the general election, you can't keep making the case then for independence, can you? That's a rejection by the voters of the argument you're making.
Well, look, sorry, I'm not going to sit here now several months out from an election and concede that election. We're in it to win it, and I'm confident we can do that. We've laid out already. We debated at our party conference just last year what our position will be if we win a majority of seats at the coming general election. That gives us the mandate to put into effect the question we'll put to the people of Scotland, that a vote for the SNP is a vote for Scotland to become an independent country. That will be line one, page one of our manifesto. And if the people of Scotland vote for that, we win a majority of seats, and that voice should be heard.
And if you don't win a majority, that's it?
No, look, we are entering this election. I'm confident we can do well. I'm confident that we can win. And I'm not going to concede the election at this stage. If we win that election, then the voices of the people of Scotland should be listened to, and we should be able to advance the case and move towards independence.
Just finally, Jamie, while I've got you, last week we heard an interview I'd done with Marwee Black, who you'll know, Deputy Leader for the SNP in Westminster. She told me she thought some of her colleagues in Westminster actually quite enjoyed being there. Let's just take a listen.
I've seen folk who you would have thought would have been the first one marching to the border with a claymore, but now absolutely love being in London. You know, you think, I wouldn't have expected that. You know, some of your
SNP colleagues actually quite like being part of the Westminster bubble.
I will not specify if they are current or not, but yes, I've come across ones where I've thought, you're slightly. Or you appear slightly more comfortable than I think you should be.
And then another one of your colleagues, Joanna Cherry, yesterday said that Marwee Black should quit or apologise, saying she'd hampered the chances of many colleagues were facing difficulties to hang on to their seats. Is Marwee Black right? Do some of your colleagues get a bit too cosy there, or should she apologise?
Well, I'm not looking for colleagues to march to the border holding claymores, as she put it. What I'm looking for them to do is to be elected there to advance the cause of independence and be there for as short a time as possible. And when I speak to my colleagues who are at Westminster, I know that's exactly what they seek to do. They're down there to make the case for independence and then come home to help build a better society here in Scotland through having the powers of independence.
Do you agree with Joanna Cherry that she should quit or apologise?
Marwee Black's doing a good job as deputy leader, and I know she'll continue to do so.
Great stuff. Jamie, good to speak to you. Jamie Hepburn there, Minister for Independence in the SNP government in Holyrood. And no doubt we'll keep across everything that's happening in Scottish politics in what is going to be an extraordinary year right across the UK. Do get in touch if you've got any comments or complaints about the podcast. You can email me matt@times.radio or post a review on the Apple Podcasts, particularly if it's about my face. But for now, from me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Are you ready for truly hydrated skin? Meet Hyaluronic Body Serum, a breakthrough in body care from Osea. It's clinically proven to instantly increase hydration by 161%. Their lightweight, fast-absorbing serum delivers 24 hours of nonstop hydration for silky, smooth skin without the sticky afterfeel. Osea's latest innovation combines the magic of their best-selling Hyaluronic C Serum with a new formula that's good for the whole body and 5 types of hyaluronic acid to target every layer of the skin. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been crafting seaweed-powered products for nearly 30 years. The best part? Everything Osea makes is clean, vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Treat your skin to clean, vegan skincare from Osea. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with code SUMMER at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code SUMMER.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
on Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in...
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.